It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. If a snooty wine dealer ever treated you like a half-wit, you're going to enjoy today's guests. Dorothy Gator and John Brecher write the Tastings column in the venerable Wall Street Journal. They say you can fire your wine shop. It's anti-intimidation guerrilla tactics and tips for where to find some great wine bargains. Jane and Michael Stern are in Binghamton, New York, eating speedies at Sharky's. Writer John Willoughby wants to talk mystery meats, the cuts we're missing. Matthew Goodman, who writes about Jewish food, takes a stand on the kreplach. And we go to a public school cafeteria where the deep fryer is banned and the kids love to eat their veggies. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure. A practical guide to nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. Today, I want to talk about two seasoning tricks, things you can do to bring out more flavor or new tastes in everyday cooking. The ingredients for them are in just about every supermarket. One is flavoring with greens, and the other is using olives the way you would use herbs. Let's begin with the idea of using distinctive tasting greens to make deeper, richer flavors in lots of different dishes, like roasted vegetables, stews, soups, and roasted meats or poultry. Now, you can use any green you have available, like Swiss chard or those organic salad mixes or radicchio or kale. The basic concept is that when you brown a small amount of chopped greens, their tart, assertive flavors deepen, and they become rich-tasting. They become a counterpoint to other foods. They make everything else taste bigger and bolder. And this is a great method for adding richness without adding any extra fat. Here's how it works. When you're browning vegetables at the beginning of a recipe, like for a soup or stew, add a handful of chopped greens. Now, when you're roasting something, let's say a cut-up chicken or just a variety of vegetables, you scatter some chopped greens in the pan. And they're going to add lots of depth as they roast. I'll give you an instance. I love cutting up peppers and roasting them with herbs and big wedges of onion. Add a big handful of tart greens, let them roast with the peppers until the greens are brown and crisp, and you get this meaty, robust contrast to the sweet peppers and onions. Now, for a great accent to poached or grilled fish, toss some coarsely chopped tart greens with a little olive oil, salt, and pepper, and then brown them in a sauté pan until they're crisp. Now, don't be shy here. You really want to get them brown. You do this over medium-high heat. You don't want to burn the greens, but you want to get them crunchy. Now, that's when their character kind of flips over into this combination of rich, deep, yet really tangy flavors. Serve them with the fish or top polenta with them. Now, for another flavoring trick, and this one's directly from Italy, but it's probably used wherever olives are grown, try using black olives as a seasoning. Talk about enriching flavors. Olives can do wonders. You can cook with olives three ways. Just remember one thing. They tend to be salty, so cut back on the salt in the rest of the recipe. If you want big bowl tastes, add about a third cup of great-tasting black olives to the dish, whether it's a roast or a stew, at the beginning of cooking. For a more delicate taste, add the olives during the last 5 or 10 minutes of cooking. Say you're doing roast chicken. Roast 10 or 12 olives in the pan with the chicken and keep basting the bird with the pan juices. If you want to take that same dish and use olives in a delicate way, roast the chicken, finish it off, take it out of the pan, put the pan juices, in the pan obviously, over a burner, stir some olives into it, let it simmer a few minutes, and then spoon that sauce over the chicken. Now, in uncooked or slightly cooked dishes, good-tasting olives are the perfect contrast to high, bright flavors. You know, like the flavors from chilies or citrus juices or fresh herbs or vinegar. One great way of tasting this is in a classic Sicilian salad. Fresh orange slices, fresh fennel, oil, vinegar, and black olives. It's gorgeous to look at, and it tastes great. Okay, so what kind of olives should you use? Well, always taste olives before buying. I like oil-cured black olives. Now, these are the ones that look shriveled. They're made by curing with salt, and then they're dried in the sun or in ovens. Always taste them for an iodine aftertaste. That's a flaw. And also, taste for too much salt. But if they taste good and meaty, buy them. If you can't get oil cured, go for easy-to-find Kalamatas from Greece or France's Nice olives. So try some new flavoring tricks and join us again for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, the place where you can register for kitchen essentials, non-stick, hard, anodized cookware from Calphalon. It's professional quality, heavy cookware with tempered glass lids and ergonomic handles. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions and is distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Well, how many times has this happened to you? You want to try a wine you've heard about, so you ask for it at the local wine shop. The salesperson's nose goes up in the air and they say, "We never carry that wine." And then he recommends something twice the price. Well, our guests today have the answer to this one. They are wine experts Dorothy Gator and John Brecher. They do a wine column in the venerable Wall Street Journal, and they've written the Wall Street Journal Guide to Wine. They say if you're treated like this, fire your wine shop. Food writer and meat expert John Willoughby checks in to tell us about mystery meats, those cuts that taste incredible but you rarely hear about. Now, once you know the code, there's some pretty fine eating in store. Matthew Goodman writes about Jewish food. He claims there's one typical Jewish specialty that gets no respect. Matthew is taking a stand on the kreplach, a.k.a. Jewish ravioli. Speaking about getting no respect, how about the food in public school cafeterias, now the homes of fast food franchise and some of the most horrendous cooking on earth? Not so in two schools we just heard about. We're going to talk with a chef who turned around their cafeterias. The deep fryer is banned, the kids love the healthy, delicious food, and the operations are profitable. How about broiled steelhead trout on a bed of spinach with wild rice for $2? Then we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in the second half of the show. That number is 800-537-5252. So let's get started with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine. So Jane, Michael, what have you been up to?
We have been eating Speedies at Sharky's in Binghamton, New York.
Do you have any idea what we're talking about?
Not a clue.
Speedies at Sharky's?
It sounds like you've been gambling. What are you talking about?
No, it's a sure thing. It is no gamble. You go to a restaurant, actually a kind of family tavern called Sharky's, and you order Speedies. And you may not have heard of Speedies, but I know, Lynn, you know Speedini.
Oh, yeah. It means something that's on a skewer.
And that's what you get at Sharky's.
Binghamton, New York is one of these great ethnic towns with about five very strong ethnic groups. And of course, one of them, the strongest being their Italian American community. And Speedies is the Americanized version of Spadini. It's lamb, pork, or chicken that has been marinated for a day or two in this wonderful garlic, vinegar, pepper, and oregano marinade, put on a skewer and grilled over charcoal. I think it's over charcoal, isn't it, Michael?
It's cooked over charcoal. And one of the great things about a Speedy, as served at Sharky's, is that it is served to you on the skewer along with a stack of French bread or Italian bread, that type of kind of crusty loaf of bread,
right,
slices of it, and you use the bread as a kind of mitt to pull off two or three chunks of barbecued meat, and therefore you instantly have a sandwich in your hand, and you eat it right out of hand like that.
This sounds delicious.
It is delicious.
It is delicious. And, you know, people are so familiar with buffalo chicken wings, originated, of course, at the Anchor Bar in Buffalo, New York, as the New York specialty. But they don't realize that what buffalo wings are to Buffalo, New York, Speedy's are to Binghamton, New York. And there's Speedy festivals during the summer. I mean, the people in Binghamton take this very, very seriously.
And in fact, at Sharkey's, you can actually buy Speedy meat, which is already pre-marinated meat to take home, and then grill on your own grill, so you can have Speedy's at home, too.
And of course, Speedy's is in the Eastern European sort of area of Binghamton, and not only did they serve Speedies, but they serve wonderful halupkis, which are stuffed cabbage rolls, homemade kielbasa, and fabulous buttery pierogi filled with seasoned mashed potatoes.
This sounds so good, but now are there any garnishes with the Speedies? I mean, do you get veg or anything like that?
No.
Bread.
You get bread,
white
and
bread.
Meat, and that's it.
This sounds...
But one of the great garnishes of this meal, philosophically speaking, is the place itself. Sharkey's has been a family tavern, which may seem like a kind of oxymoron, but it a family tavern for decades. And like whole families come there. There are ancient kind of pinball-type game machines for the kids to play. There are groups of bowling teams come there to eat. The volunteer firemen come there to eat. The whole community comes there to eat Speedy's.
Yeah, it's really a local institution of the kind of place that unfortunately one is finding less and less of as the years go on. You know, one of these great kind of old-fashioned dark taverns where, as Michael said, you know, it really is a family place. It's not just a drinking tavern. But if you ever meet anyone from Binghamton and you want to impress them, just say Sharkey's, and they know you will be a Binghamton insider.
Thanks for another find, you two.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
If you're feeling fancy free, come wander through the world with me. And any place we chance to be will be our rendezvous. Two for the
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Square Meals, America's Favorite Comfort Food Cookbook. You can hear them here every week, and you can check out their road food finds anytime on our website, splendidtable.org. Food writer John Willoughby loves to research. He comes by often to share his latest travels and his cooking discoveries. He writes for lots of national publications and co-authors cookbooks with his pal Chris Slazinger. Their latest is How to Cook Meat. Hey, John, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn.
What do you want to talk about?
Well, you know, for the past 2 years, I have been up to my eyeballs in testing meat, and in the process, I've discovered a lot of underused cuts of meat that are great in flavor and relatively cheap, and I've become addicted to these cuts of meat, so I wanted to talk about those today.
Okay. What are you talking about?
Well, these are cuts that people don't ordinarily think of. They're usually cheaper than the better-known cuts, and they've got great flavor, and my number one favorite is the chuck top blade steak. Now, this is a steak that comes from the chuck or the shoulder, which is usually the tough part of the cow, but it is actually the second most tender cut of beef on the entire cow, second only to the tenderloin. And it's got great beef flavor, and it costs about 20% what a tenderloin costs. Now, so it's an amazing bargain. There is one flaw which has caused it to be not as popular as it should be. It has a line of gristle right down the center of it. But you can either just cut that gristle out after you've cooked it, or what I like to do is take this and cut out the gristle first and then use it for kebabs or stir fries or anything where you're using smaller pieces of meat. It is an unbelievable value.
You know, you're talking about what I think is one of the great pieces of beef, and you're right, it's so cheap. How would you identify it if you saw it in the market? What should we look for?
Well, one, it's got a lot of names. It's one of those cuts of meat that has many names, but the best one is the flat iron steak. It's called that because it looks like an old-fashioned iron, you know, those metal irons they used to fill with coals? Mm-hmm. So it's shaped like an old-fashioned iron. And
like a triangle, almost.
Like a triangle, right. It's got a line of gristle right down the center of it. You can't miss it.
Okay.
But make sure you get the chuck top blade steak, or called the flat iron steak, because that's the one you want.
Does it have a bone in it?
Nope, no bone. This is boneless meat.
Okay, all right. Okay, we're into the mystery cuts, I gathered. So, have you got
mystery cuts, not mystery meat.
These no, are I like this. I yeah. like this. This is the kind of stuff that's really important to know. Okay, what's next?
Well, my other, I think might be my absolute favorite, is called the pork butt. Now, this is a cut of meat that, despite what you might think, does not come from the rump. It comes from the front leg of the pig. And it is a very tender piece of meat. It's got some fat in it, but that's a good thing now because pork is so lean that you need some fat if you're going to braise something. And this is the most popular cut of pork in China. That's what they make all those great braised Chinese-style pork dishes with.
Mm-hmm.
It's also tender enough to roast. So we like to roast it on a bed of vegetables, which gives it a little added moisture, and it comes out incredibly tender, full of pork flavor. Really a delicious cut, and it's very cheap.
Now, is this the pork shoulder? Will it ever be labeled pork shoulder, or is it always called the butt?
Sometimes it's labeled Boston butt. Usually it's labeled butt. You want to watch out for the ones labeled the shoulder. They're usually called picnic shoulder.
Uh-huh.
And they're great for braising, but they're not nearly as tender or flavorful as the butt. And they come from the lower part of the arm. The butt comes right from the shoulder. So it'll sometimes be called shoulder parentheses butt. But butt will always be in the name.
Okay, so when you think pork roast, think butt. That's good.
There you go.
All right.
That's easy to remember.
All right, I want another one.
Okay, here's a great one. This is another beef one. To me, this is maybe the most flavorful cut of beef that there is. This is the skirt steak. This is what originally fajitas were made out of, which is why fajitas became so popular. It is a flat steak that comes from down by the diaphragm of the cow. It doesn't, you know, it's not like those thick porterhouses. It's flat, and it's got a lot of grain in it. It's very grainy, has a horizontal grain. If you cook it fast, grilling is the best way to cook this, and then slice it on the bias, it becomes very tender. I really like this cut, too, because it has a little bit more fat than the hanger steak. The hanger steak is very popular in Parisian-style bistros and for steak frites, but I think that the skirt steak, because it has a little more fat, has even better flavor. This is the absolute best cut of meat for a steak frite, which is just a plain steak with French fried potatoes. This is an awesome cut of beef.
Mm. Are there any bargains in veal?
Absolutely. The interesting thing about veal is it makes great stew. Now, you don't usually think of veal for stew meat. You usually think of it as a very sort of high tone kind of meat, but it's fantastic in peasant style stews because it's so young, it has an amazing amount of collagen in it. And collagen, when you cook it, it dissolves into a kind of gelatin. And when you cook veal cuts for stew, first of all, they're cheaper than any other cut of meat. And when you cook them, that collagen dissolves and you get this amazingly silky, suave, sort of rich sauce. It makes a fantastic stew.
John, dynamite, the mystery cuts. We saved some money. Hey, thanks.
Thank you, Lynn.
John Willoughby is co-author of How to Cook Meat. You can get his recipe for lime-soaked, cumin-encrusted, grilled skirt steak with green olive chili relish. This guy loves descriptors. On our website, that's splendidtable.org. Coming up, Wall Street Journal wine columnists tell us how to check out a wine shop and find some bargains, and we'll be taking your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions, and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week. Online at Target.com. Did you know that every Friday the Wall Street Journal has a dynamite wine column? It's a down-to-earth, fun read. It's called Tastings. It's written by the husband and wife team of Dorothy Gator and John Brecher. They've also done the book, The Wall Street Journal Guide to Wine. Dorothy Gator and John Brecher, welcome.
Hi.
All right, you two. How do we get your jobs? I mean, is it years and years of working in wine?
Well, actually, we were very serious journalists before we started doing this. I wrote about race in America for 27 years, and there are not a lot of laughs there, and it was pretty heavy lifting.
And I was page one editor of the Wall Street Journal for 7 years, but we've been lifelong wine enthusiasts. We've been studying it and drinking wine since we first met June 4th, 1973. We never thought about writing it, but 25 years later, we are.
Do you actually know what time it was on June 4th, 1973?
Probably around 9 o'clock. He was wearing gray flannel pants and dark-rimmed glasses, and he was just drop-dead handsome.
And she was so cute.
I love this. This is wonderful. But okay, you love wine. A lot of us love wine. But how this column I like. It's casual. I mean, it sounds like you're talking to me.
Well, you know, the idea of the column is that, on the whole, people don't want to be educated about wine. For years and years, we were the people in the office who people walked up to and said, look, my wife just called and said, I got to bring home a red wine to have with meat. What in the heck do I get? Nobody ever came up to us and said, could you explain malolactic fermentation to us? So we brought that sense to the column.
Right. People don't care about that stuff. They just want to know, what should I bring home tonight? What would be good?
Yeah, and what does it taste like? Well, you know, I want to talk about the column that made me a fan. It was called Fire Your Wine Shop. And I love the fact that you got a letter from a reader who had gone to their wine shop to ask about a wine you had suggested. And they were told by the dealer there that not only did the wine not exist, but the region the wine came from didn't exist. So, Dorothy, I mean, what should we expect from a wine shop?
Well, they ought to tell you the truth. They ought to say, you know, they make very good wines there, but I don't have any. Can I suggest something else that's similar? A wine shop should be a very fun place. You should look forward to going as if you would a candy shop. You know, you shouldn't have to gird up for battle to have to deal with a wine merchant who's going to be intimidating you and condescending. It should be a fun experience. And if it's not, you should go someplace else.
John, do you have some real pet annoyances with wine shops?
Our very least favorite question is when you walk into a wine shop and some guy attaches himself to you and he says, so, do you like red or white? You know, I don't know about you. I've never walked into a bookstore in my life where someone has attached themselves to me and said, so, fiction or nonfiction? I don't know why they do it in a wine shop.
Okay, but how does a novice know that they're going to get a bum steer in a place? I mean, are there signs to look for?
Well, as a matter of fact, literally there are signs to look for. There are many ways to deconstruct a wine shop without asking any questions. If you walk in and it's really hot, the wine is suffering, and that's a bad sign. If you walk in and you see handmade signs, those are indeed signs. It's an indication that the wine shop owner is really into wine, is excited about it, and wants to get you excited about it. So that if you just see handmade signs, something small like that, that's a good sign.
If the store's dirty, you really don't want to be there. You know, if the bottles are really dusty, it's a nice cave feeling, but really that means that the bottles aren't moving. They've probably been there a while. You want to get out of there.
The important point is that there are really are terrific shops out there all over the country, and not just precious little wine shops, but we hear from people all the time who go to places like Trader Joe's and Harris Teeter supermarkets and Costco. So you don't have to suffer with a bad wine shop.
Well, in places like that, it's generally a serve yourself sort of deal, right? I mean, in big chains.
In many, it is. It is. And the advantage of getting to know a wine merchant at a wine store is that if you find a good one, it's really worth its weight in gold. And after all, even if a wine is inexpensive, it's still too expensive if it's bad wine. So even if a small shop might charge a little bit more, if you're getting good advice from someone you trust, our feeling is that it's worth it.
It's also a question of taste, isn't it? Someone says, I like this wine. Why don't you try it? And if you find you like it, you know you can go back to them, right?
That's right. That's exactly right. We tell people that a good wine is a wine that tastes good to you. End of definition. And if you find someone who has similar taste to yours, that person's golden.
Okay. How much weight do you two put on these wine ratings, like in Wine Spectator or other magazines?
We rate wines ourselves on our own scale, the one we used for 25 years before we became wine writers, which starts with yek, then goes to okay, good, very good, delicious, and the very rare delicious with an exclamation mark. But what we always tell people is whether it's our rating or someone else's rating, remember that it's our rating or someone else's rating, not necessarily your rating. You need to decide for yourself what you think of a wine, and you can't let anyone else tell you what you like.
Do you ever shop on the web?
Actually, we shop on the web all the time. There are literally hundreds of stores now all over the country that are on the web, and it's a tremendous, tremendous resource. Now, because of very strange state laws, there are some states where you can't order from out of state online and get it delivered to you. But even if you're in one of those states, at least you can look at these various sites to see what's available at good stores and how much it costs.
And that gives you a ballpark. Do you have some sites you really like, some you'd like to recommend?
There are sites really from all over the country. Wally Wine, which is Wally's wine store in Los Angeles, is very good. Sam's Wine, which is Sam's Wine in Chicago, is a terrific site. Astor Uncorked, which is Astor Wine Shop in New York, and Zaki's, which is in Westchester County, and Sherry Lehman, which is a very fine shop in New York City, all have very, very good sites. But the truth is that any shop these days that you've ever heard of, if you look on the web, you might well see their selection right there online.
Sounds like a good guide. Hey, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Dorothy Gator and John Brecher write the Tastings column that appears each Friday in the Wall Street Journal. Their book is The Wall Street Journal Guide to Wine. Matthew Goodman writes about food for the Jewish publication The Forward. He's taken us down some unexpected paths in the past, like the Jewish origins of fish and chips in London. We always like to get his take on stuff. Matthew, welcome.
Hi, Lynn.
So what have you been mulling over lately?
Well, what I've been mulling over is the sorry reputation of my beloved Kreplach. I'd love to do what I can to help resuscitate that reputation.
All right, wait a minute. You've got to explain what Kreplach is.
Right. Most people don't even know what Kreplach is. Kreplach is a small, triangular-shaped, filled pasta. It's really wonderful. And, you know, pasta is all the rage these days. You know, I mean, Shanghai soup dumplings are everywhere, and ravioli is made by chefs from Batali to Boyardee, and pierogies are in the frozen food sections of supermarkets. And you would think that Kreplach would be, you know, riding that wave, but it's hard to find Kreplach almost anywhere. You know, I think part of the problem that Kreplach has is the name, Kreplach. You know, it's got that kind of guttural huh sound. It sounds like the punchline of a borscht belt routine, which is too bad because it really is a wonderful food.
Well, first of all, okay, so this is pasta. What is not to like here?
Exactly.
What's the origins of this?
Right.
Ravioli, well, if you'll pardon the expression.
The word Kreplach seems to have come from the Latin word crespa, meaning pastry, which is where we get the French crepe as well. Because that's really what Kreplach is. It's a savory pastry. The first written record that we have of something resembling kreplach goes back to about the 12th century in France, to a dish that consisted of all things, a bird's stomach that had soft dough wrapped around it, and that was called crepish. And then in later centuries, as Jews migrated from Western to Central and then Eastern Europe, and Yiddish became their primary language, crepish became known as kreplach. And, you know, you didn't any longer see bird's stomachs or bird's intestines, thankfully, as the filling. But, you know, you began to see ground meat or cheese or fruit as the filling. And these kreplach were mainly baked or fried. It wasn't until later centuries, really around the 17th century, that you began to see kreplach boiled in water or in broth, which is the preparation that's most common today. Mostly what you see today are kreplach that are filled with ground beef and sometimes fried onions and herbs like dill, and simmered in chicken soup as an alternative to matzo balls or noodles and some such thing. It's a lot like wonton soup. And you know, when the Jewish immigrants started coming here around the turn of the last century, they were living on the Lower East Side, which is right next to Chinatown.
You're talking about New York City, right?
In New York City, right? A lot of the Chinese restaurants in Chinatown advertised their wonton soup as chicken soup with kreplach to try to get Jewish patrons. Now, I'm guessing that they did not mention that their wontons were filled with pork, but there you have it.
I would hope not. I'm also glad in one regard that the bird stomach left the scene. I think
that hasn't been seen for probably 500 years, I'm guessing.
Perhaps this is a good thing.
Well, you know, as I said, usually what you find in kreplach now is ground beef in chicken soup, which is really fine as far as it goes. That tradition is really quite wonderful. Uh-huh. But there are really all kinds of other things that you can do with kreplach, which are variations on that theme that are really quite wonderful. I often don't simmer kreplach in soup. I fry kreplach. You can have meat kreplach fried with onions. It's really quite wonderful. Faye Levy, in her recent book called 1,000 Jewish Recipes, has a recipe for spiced chicken kreplach. Jane Cohen has a recipe for salmon-filled kreplach. Probably my favorite kreplach is sweet potato kreplach, lightly flavored with coriander, fried up with some caramelized onions, topped with sour cream. It is absolutely mouthwatering. And if you want to simmer it in soup, you can forego the chicken soup and simmer it in some borscht, topped with a dollop of sour cream. And the beets and the borscht and the sweet potatoes come together perfectly. That's my own borscht belt routine. It's really quite wonderful. You know, there's a Yiddish expression that says one gets bored even of eating kreplach. But you know what? With so many variations, you know, a little boredom isn't necessarily such a bad thing.
Okay, Matthew, just for you, I promise, we'll take a new look at kreplach.
Then I feel I've done my job.
Thanks, Matthew.
Thank you.
Matthew Goodman writes for the national Jewish publication, The Forward. You can get his recipe for sweet potato stuffed kreplach with fried onions and sour cream. Two ways. Either send a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101. Or go to our website, splendidtable.org.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me.
Well, the lines are officially open for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we'll talk. Okay, let's get right to it. We've got John calling. So, John, what's on your mind?
Well, Lynn, I received a gift of a set of spices and herbs. It's a rack-type thing.
Uh-huh.
Has about a dozen bottles of different spices in it. It has one. It's called Fohngreek, F-O-E-N-G-R-E-E-K.
Oh, but one pronunciation is fenugreek.
All right, fenugreek.
Whatever. Whatever.
They're about the size of a peppercorn.
Yeah, it's little nubby.
Brown.
Brown, right?
Yeah.
And what does it smell like?
It's kind of a cross between cinnamon and nutmeg.
Mm.
It's very, very hard. I've tried soaking them. I've tried pounding them. They just don't like to be broken up. What would it be used for?
Oh, what you have got in fenugreek is one of the mainstays of Indian cooking. And it's used all over the subcontinent of India. And it has, along with what you're describing, that aroma, if you were to taste it, if you would take one and sort of just bite into it, you know?
Well, I've tried putting it in my mouth, and it's a darn hard. I'm afraid that I'd end up with a trip to the dentist if I tried to really chew on it.
Well, one of the things that is, it has a bitter undertone as well. And
okay.
it's typically sauteed or roasted and sauteed into dishes with lentils, Indian dishes we're talking about here, with lentils and vegetables. For instance, green beans with lentils made into a spicy stew. And you would saute the fenugreek with things like fresh ginger and brown mustard seed and garlic.
Uh-huh.
And then you'd stir fry into that mixture the green beans. And then you'd add a little water or tomato and you'd let that simmer.
Oh, okay.
Now I agree with you. I think they're as hard as little rocks. I've had them whole. I mean, they're left whole in this, and I always am afraid of getting one in my teeth. You could kind of pick them out, too.
Will they dissolve?
They never break up. I mean, they really just kind of stay that way. But the idea is they go with things like legumes, especially lentils, and vegetables, green beans, anything in the cabbage family. And they've got this spicy, bitter, really appealing kind of flavor to them. And if you check out Indian cookbooks, like cookbooks by Maya Kaimal, Julie Sani, you're going to find Indian recipes is the direction to go in here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And great vegetable stews. So try it in that, and anything that has a curry overtone, throw a few in there.
Okay.
Saute them or roast them first.
Would you give me the pronunciation again, the way you did?
I don't know if I'm famous for my mispronunciation, but it would be fenugreek.
Fenugreek.
Yeah, it's sort of
F-E-N.
F-E-N, yeah.
Okay, because I looked it up in my Webster's New World Dictionary of Culinary Arts by Levinsky and Ingram.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have this spelling. Perhaps it does have the fenugreek.
The spelling I've seen, it probably has several spellings, but it's F-E-N-U-G-R-E-E-K.
I'll look it up under that.
But since it's a foreign word for all of us, we're probably bastardizing it in some way.
Hey, I do appreciate you solving this problem for me, because it's been very vexing to me.
Well, John, go for the Indian food. You're going to love it. It's wonderfully.
Okay, here it is. Fenugreek. F-E-N-U-G-R-E-E-K.
You got it. You got
it. Thank you very much.
Enjoy, John.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for our trivia question of the week. You know how food additives are reviled these days, and people talk about going back to the good old days when our food was pure? So this week's question is, in the early 1800s in London, what was used to make white bread? We'll be back in a moment with that answer, a conversation with a man who has made a school cafeteria the envy of local restaurants, and we'll take more of your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions, and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We have open lines for your calls this hour, so give us a ring. The number is 800-537-5252, and we will talk. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. It's about our worries over food additives and our yearning for simpler times. Our question was, in the 1800s in London, what was used to make white bread? Well, writers in the early 1800s in London talk about bread made with chalk, alum, plaster, bone ashes, and maybe even some flour. All this was done to save money on good wheat and make the bread white. For the consumer at that time, white bread was everything. It was pure, it was better for you, and it was tastier. Butter was amended with candle grease and cooking fats from kitchens. You got rid of the rancid tastes by salting it to a fare-thee-well. Milk was watered down and adulterated with everything from cabbage leaves to chemicals, maybe even some white lead. And pasteurization wasn't going to come on the scene until the 1890s. As far as refrigeration went, that was a dream. A bag of peppercorns that you'd pick up at the grocery store for grinding at home could contain as much filth swept up from the warehouse floors where the pepper was piled as actual spice. Spicing your food takes on a whole new meaning. So much for the purity of the past. Finally, pure food laws were passed. They required that what was in the food be stated on the product's label. We may not love the additives, but usually we know they're there. Except for a recent wrinkle, genetically engineered foods. The FDA proposes that no mention of genetically engineered foods appear on any labels. But unlike our ancestors, we've got a say here. We all have until April 1 to let the FDA know what we think. Okay, guys, let's get back to the phones. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see who has been waiting. Linda's on the line. Linda, what pressing matter would you like to discuss?
Frozen foods.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's pretty pressing. All right.
I often will buy a half or a quarter of a side of beef or pork or what have you.
Right.
Or a whole bunch of chicken when they're on sale and stick them in the freezer.
Uh-huh.
And then I'll get this wild urge to do this cooking for a day, eating for a month kind of a thing.
Right.
And it's very expensive to just go out and buy all the food, but yet I don't want to thaw the frozen meat and cook it and then refreeze it again. And I'm wondering, is it going to suffer a loss in food taste and quality and nutrition and all of that if I thaw it, cook it, freeze it?
If you defrost the meat and use it right away, you know, so you defrost it, you cook it, and you freeze that food right away, you're fine. Now you will have, every time you freeze something and defrost it, you have some loss of liquid. Okay?
Okay.
Because the cells within the structure, especially of meats, tends to rupture and release some of its juices. So with that is going some nutrients and that kind of thing. And you lose some flavor. But it depends on how you're cooking it, you know, what you're putting it in. If you're making a big pot of chili or a stew, then what you have there is enough other things to make up the difference for, you know, any loss of flavor. But as long as you defrost it and use it immediately and then freeze it again.
Now, immediately, does that mean I can defrost it on Friday afternoon and cook it on Saturday?
Yes. Yes. Now, just let's make sure that when you're saying defrost it on Friday afternoon, that means either you're defrosting it in the refrigerator or you're defrosting it in a big bowl of ice water and you've got it submerged.
Oh, so that doesn't mean leaving it out on the counter all
That's
night.
How you can kill yourself.
Yeah, but you know, I grew up with my mother doing that.
I know. Everyone says the same thing. Linda, all I can tell you is there are a lot of tummy aches and other problems we all grew up with, too, which come from that. The other thing is that now we've got new strains of bacteria, you know, E. coli and that kind of thing.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, I would, please, I don't know how to be adamant enough about it. Never do it. See, the ideal incubator for the bacteria is between 40 and 140 degrees. And what you're doing, if you're defrosting that way, you really shouldn't even cook the meat and eat it. Yeah. I want to scare you. That's what I'm doing. I want to terrify you. No, because it's dangerous. And if you have anybody you're feeding who has an impaired immune system, you know, or whatever, you can really, really, you know, be doing not good things. So all you have to do is stick in a bowl of ice water. And in several hours, it'll be defrosted. Just keep it cold.
Now, won't that wreck the flavor even worse?
No, because you've got it sealed in a bag or something. Yeah, you're not letting it sit there all by itself in the water. Keep it sealed in some sort of heavy plastic.
All right.
Okay?
Well, all right. Thank you.
So, yeah, defrost.
I love your show.
Hey, thanks.
All right. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Hillary's calling. So, Hillary, what's up?
Well, I have two questions about bananas.
Bananas, okay.
One is simply that I've had a dessert called Bananas Foster several times, but I've never been able to find a recipe for it. And it seems like it's a kind of old-fashioned dessert that restaurants used to serve, but you can't really find anymore.
Oh, yeah.
And I would love to make it.
Uh-huh.
So I'd love a recipe for it. And the other is, I was once in Germany at a restaurant where they served me a piece of fish that was prepared like sort of butterflied or, you know, kind of the fish was sort of wrapped around a banana and other things, I can't remember what, and then I think it was breaded and fried. And it was a very strange-sounding combination, but one of the most delicious things
really?
I've ever had.
Because I have to tell you, right now I'm thinking, only in Germany could they do this. They think of the banana as a sausage, and they're wrapping a fish around it. This is insane.
It sounds bizarre, I know.
But it's
but
good.
It was really good. It was like, I think it was like with raisins, and, you know, it was kind of a sweet with like a filet, like a white, very light kind of, you know,
you know what? I don't think I could really go there. Let's go back to Bananas Foster. I don't know the dish, but Bananas,
right.
Now Bananas Foster, this dish is fascinating. We used it as a trivia question a while ago. It is a dish that was created at this wonderful New Orleans restaurant called Brennan's. And it was evidently created for a man who came in to dine often, and he had an awning company. His name was Foster, and it was the Foster Awning Company, and they made this dish for him. I don't know if this is the exact recipe, but I can give you the idea of how it's done. You take about a half a stick of butter and around a cup of sugar, brown sugar, dark brown, some cinnamon, okay? And if you like vanilla, and you put that in a skillet and you heat that and you make it bubbly.
Okay.
You add to that the cut up bananas, and they're usually cut lengthwise and then in half. So you get, for one banana, you get four pieces of banana. And then you add rum to that, like a quarter of a cup. You warm it and you flame it.
Okay.
And so you put it over vanilla ice cream. Is that what you're familiar
that's
with?
That's it.
Okay, kid, that's the recipe.
It is delicious.
It is outrageous. I mean, what could be bad? Butter,
exactly.
Brown sugar, and rum.
And easy to do.
And easy to do, exactly. I mean, you put all that together, and you've got to have something that's good.
Yeah, use dark rum, right?
Dark rum, if you can get it, yeah.
Okay.
Myers rum or something like that.
Great.
Okay, and by the way, be careful when you flame it, because Myers rum, for instance, is 150 proof.
Right.
Your eyebrows can be singed. Stand way back. Stand way back.
Yeah. Okay. And then you just let it burn itself out.
Yeah, it burns itself out. Right.
Right.
And then you spoon the banana and the sauce over ice cream. Oh, God.
Sounds fantastic.
Really good.
Thank you so much.
Hey, you're welcome.
Appreciate it.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Well, we've got Ruth on the line. Ruth, what's on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. It's nice to talk to you.
Oh, thank you for calling. What do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about St. Patrick's Day. Because I'm an artist sculptor living in New York City, and I just happen to have an art opening on St. Patrick's Day, March the 17th.
Uh-huh.
And I'd really love to serve green beer to my guests. And I've had some friends tell me that all green beer is food coloring in the beer. Is this really true?
As far as I know it is. I'm not a beer expert, but yeah.
Because, you know, I was worried that I would have to crush up four-leaf clovers and somehow get it inside a keg or something.
What kind of artist are you, by the way? What kind of work do you do?
I'm a sculptor. I work in polyester resin. I cast and make molds and embed objects inside clear resin, and then I polish it until it's, like, crystal clear.
Well, it sounds gorgeous.
Yeah.
That sounds great. Where are you from, by the way? You don't sound like a native New Yorker.
No, I'm not. I'm from Australia, and I've lived in New York City for about 7 years.
Does anybody drink green beer in Australia?
Well, we certainly celebrate St. Patrick's Day, but I've never really heard much about the green beer thing. It's a little bit alien.
Well, throw some green food coloring in some beer and you'll be home free.
Okay, thank you very much, Lynn.
You're welcome and good luck with the opening.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Public school cafeteria food can be pretty shameful. Fast food chains are gaining ground, and limited school budgets are making preparing any decent food pretty tough. Well, we recently heard about a man who changed much of this. Paul Carenti is chef and food director at two public school cafeterias in Harvard, Massachusetts. The menus at these schools read like a three-star restaurant. How about steelhead trout fillet on a bed of spinach with julienned vegetables and dill, along with tomato Florentine soup and wild rice pilaf and fruit salad for $2. Paul Carenti is on the phone. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Howdy.
Okay, Paul, what's on the menu today?
Let's see, what do we have today? We had Mexican chicken tortilla soup. We also had Kung Pao chicken as our hot entree. We had B.A. Sloppy Joe's on the next line. We also that was accompanied by fresh pineapple, pasta salad, steamed rice, fortune cookies.
Oh.
That's only one choice. And then we have a full salad bar and a sub shop and pizza.
Well, some of this sounds like food that an adult could love, but how are the kids reacting to it?
Oh, very well. Kids today are a lot more sophisticated than when we went to school, and kids are much more aware of nutrition nowadays. So we've actually found that schools, educators lag behind the kids in nutrition education. So we went directly to the kids and asked them what they wanted, and they told us. And even though we do the steelhead trout and things, a lot of what we do is plain old home cooking. And, you know, you've got 14 ladies working for you. They're mothers and grandmothers. And you say, look, these are like your kids. Cook like they're your kids. And they've really done a great job doing that. You know, and they take as much care as if these were their kids. Because, you know, home cooking isn't so common anymore.
That's true.
Fresh roast turkey dinner, or we have turkey stew. We make cornbread and put green peppers and red peppers and hot sauce in it and cut it in a triangle and ladle the stew over that. It's very simple, but people don't do that anymore. And kids go nuts when they see that stuff.
Sounds great. Hey, is there any fast food sold in the cafeteria?
Yeah, we do. We'll do chicken nuggets, but we'll do them once every 3 weeks. We won't. A lot of schools will do those things every day.
Uh-huh.
And if you do that every day, kids will eat them every day. But what we've done is they trust us now, so that whatever we put out there, they will trust us and try it. And if they don't like it, there's no questions asked. If they don't like it, they can get whatever they want or get their money back, you know.
All right, but how do you do this on a school budget?
Well, everybody says that. I come from a restaurant background. This is the first school I worked in. So I come from this looking at it as a restaurateur. So I don't look at food cost. If you look at food cost and try to have a low food cost, what you wind up with is the cheapest quality food you can find, and that's not going to sell. So what you have to do is bring in attractive food that the kids will eat. And let's face it, kids have more disposable income than any of us because they have no overhead. And if a kid has $10 in his pocket, they're always hungry. They need like 5,000 calories a day, right?
Uh-huh.
So they're going to spend it on food. So what we do is we make pennies on each meal, but every kid eats a meal every single day. Plus, we sell things like we do catering outside of the school through the school lunch program. We do barbecues. We do all these things, and it brings money back to the school lunch program.
So that's how you use that money to help cover the costs of feeding the kids every day.
Sure. The problem in a lot of schools is the food is unattractive. It's unattractively prepared, and the mentality is these kids, they're a captive audience, and they have to eat here or else. So what you wind up with is, like when I came to this school district, the participation was 24%. 24% of the kids were eating lunch, which is atrocious. Because kids have to eat, and they have to eat a lot, and they have to eat often,
mm-hmm.
You know, when they're teens.
And they have to eat well.
They have to eat well.
Yeah.
And we found that once the kids trust you, you know, if you listen to them, it's so unusual that anybody listens to kids, that they respect you. The ladies are really well respected. We have a really good time. We laugh all the time with them. The kids come in and tell us what they want. We have kids that work in the kitchen with us for credit. So we're actually a part of the school and a part of their life. And the best part of this job is it's so much fun. I mean, I would never go back into restaurant work, ever, because you're dealing with kids. And so you can get away with things. Like, we're kind of on their side because we're not teachers. So I mentioned we have a thing called a BA.
Yeah, you said
Sloppy
something.
Joe.
Yeah, what's a
we
BA?
We put it on the menu board, and a teacher will come up and go, "What's that mean?" And we'll go, "Oh, big American." But the kids know it as a big ass because it's like double-sized. Hey, give me one of them BA subs because it's got like 8 meatballs in it. So, I mean, it's kind of like an underground. It's almost like an inside joke. And what we try to do is make school lunch their time. It's their social hour. So we're really on their side.
Paul, you're the Alice Waters of the East Coast with a dynamite sense of humor.
Best, you know? Well, you know, what strikes me is strange is that there are all these magazines, there's all this information, there's shows like yours, there's the Food Network, and it has not trickled down to the school level, which is the most critical. I don't know if there's a direct correlation, but the kids here just chow big time, and this school has finished first in the state in the MCAS scores, which is tests in the 8th, 10th, and I believe 12th grade, almost like an SAT.
Mm-hmm.
And this school has finished first for 3 years running.
Feed them well and they will flourish.
Hey, and coffee in the morning helps too.
Paul, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Paul Carinti is chef and food service director for the Bromfield Public School in Harvard, Massachusetts. Well, that's the show for today, everybody. Thanks for being with us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with a bit of wisdom from Will Shakespeare. 'Tis an ill cook who cannot lick his own fingers. The Splendid Table is brought to you by the kitchenware area at Target, where you'll find Bialetti cookware lines that feature Teflon platinum interiors, polished aluminum bottoms, and stainless steel handles. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. Our theme music is composed by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.